Imagine buying a brand new beautiful house for like $80,000. You pay cash and you feel like you've finally hacked the housing market, right?
Oh, yeah. Best feeling in the world.
Right. But now imagine walking into a bank to get a small loan for, say, some landscaping. And the loan officer looks at you and tells you that according to their system, your brand new house is technically a car.
Yep. Welcome to the bizarre reality of the modern small home movement.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because for decades, if you pictured the classic Canadian dream home, a very specific image popped up in your head, you know.
Absolutely. The single family house, the fenced-in grassy lot.
Yeah, exactly. A sprawling basement for storing all your seasonal gear and a paved driveway out front. That was it.
It's the default blueprint. I mean, we've been conditioned to visualize that exact configuration when we hear the word home. And our entire financial and legal system, it was basically built around that single image.
But the reality of the world right now is that this picture is shifting, like, incredibly rapidly. You've probably seen those stunning photos on social media of tiny homes tucked into a forest,
Oh, all over the
or
place.
like ultra-modern modular cabins sitting on the edge of a lake. And they look incredible, but they completely shatter that traditional fenced lot image.
They really do.
That single-family house with the basement is still a version of a home, sure, but it is no longer the only one.
No, not at all. We are looking at a landscape where the traditional housing model is, frankly, increasingly out of reach for a massive portion of the
Yeah,
population.
the prices are just wild.
Exactly. Or it simply doesn't align with how people want to live anymore. I mean, they don't want to spend their weekends mowing a giant lawn or, dropping their entire paycheck on a mortgage.
Which brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. We're looking at a really fascinating guide today called Small Home Solutions, a comprehensive financing and zoning guide.
It's a great resource.
It really is. And we are going to cut through the Instagram filters and break down the hard mechanics here. What actually are these homes legally? How do you finance them?
Which is a huge question.
Massive. And what are the zoning rules you absolutely cannot ignore? Plus, what do you really need to consider before making a move?
Because it's not just an aesthetic choice.
Right. This isn't just about downsizing your closet. It's about navigating a surprisingly complex legal and financial system.
Yeah, and the source material grounds this in a very practical reality. It specifically looks at places like the Kootenays in British Columbia.
Beautiful area, but tough terrain.
Oh, incredibly rugged geography.
Yeah.
And the housing market there is notoriously challenging. So in regions like that, alternative homes aren't just cute novelties.
Right.
They are practical, everyday housing choices. People are making these moves because they want lower bills and less maintenance.
Makes total sense.
But the guide is very clear. To get that freedom, you have to understand the mechanics of how the system views your home.
So let's start with the language problem, because I feel like this is where it all gets messy. In casual conversation, we throw around terms like tiny home or modular interchangeably.
All the time.
It's like using the word Kleenex. You hand someone a generic tissue, call it a Kleenex,
Yeah.
and everyone knows what you mean, right?
Right. The brand becomes the noun.
Exactly.
Huh.
But legally, if you walk into a planning office and say, hey, I want to build a tiny home, that could mean a glorified RV, or it could mean a permanent immovable dwelling.
And the terminology is where the entire process usually derails right at the starting line. Because frankly, the bank doesn't care about the aesthetic.
They really don't.
No. What they care about and what your local government cares about are the Canadian Standards Association, or CSA, codes.
Okay, the codes.
Yeah. These codes are the mechanical foundation of your project. They dictate the engineering. The engineering dictates the risk. And the risk dictates the money.
Okay, walk us through this alphabet soup of housing codes. What are the actual categories we need to understand?
Oh, this is the best part. So there are four main categories to keep straight. The absolute gold standard for lenders is the modular home. These fall under the CSA A277 code. They are built in sections in a climate-controlled factory. They're transported, and then they're assembled on a permanent foundation.
So they're bolted down.
Exactly. To almost all lenders and municipalities, an A277 modular home on a permanent foundation is structurally and legally indistinguishable from a traditional house built from scratch on site. What's fascinating here is that the system understands permanence.
Right, because it has a concrete foundation, it's tied to the earth.
Yes. But then you step over to mobile or manufactured homes. These are CSA Z240.
Z240, got it.
And the defining structural feature here is that they are built on a steel chassis. You often see these in mobile home parks on leased pads, though. I mean, they can be put on owned land, too.
Wait, I have to pause you right there. Why does a steel frame underneath the floorboards change the financial conversation? Like, if the house is skirted, hooked up to utilities, and looks totally permanent.
Because of mobility. From a risk perspective, a steel chassis implies the structure can technically be towed away.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you can't steal a concrete basement. A bank's entire risk model relies on the collateral staying exactly where it was when they wrote the check. If the asset can move, the risk profile skyrockets.
Wow, that makes perfect sense when you look at it through the lens of a bank's algorithm.
Mm.
So A277 is modular and permanent. Z240 has the steel chassis. What's next?
Park models. These fall under CSA Z241. This is a hybrid category sitting somewhere between a recreational vehicle and a manufactured home.
Okay, like for a summer camp.
Yeah, exactly. They are designed for long-term placement, maybe a summer lot by a lake, but they aren't engineered to standard residential house codes. What's fascinating here is that we are actually starting to see municipalities recognize Z241s as legitimate full-time dwellings.
Really?
Yeah, but it is highly dependent on local climate and insulation upgrades. You can't just drop one anywhere.
Fair enough. And finally, we have the wild card, right?
Oh, yeah. The famous tiny home on wheels.
The one everyone sees on social media.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is where the rules fracture completely. If a tiny home on wheels is built to RV standards, lenders and municipalities will treat it as a recreational vehicle, period.
There's no full-time living.
Right. You generally cannot live in it full-time legally in a residential zone. But if that same tiny home on wheels is engineered to a recognized residential standard, the wheels are removed and it's placed on a permanent foundation.
It totally shifts categories.
Suddenly it's a completely different conversation.
So the building standard is the actual gatekeeper. You can't even talk about getting a mortgage or buying land until you know exactly which of those CSA codes is stamped on the structure.
Not a chance.
Which sets up a huge revelation from the source material. The loan you need depends less on the house itself and heavily on the dirt underneath it.
The dirt dictates the dollars. That's the golden rule here. Lenders categorize risk based on land ownership first and the structure second.
Okay, break that down for us.
Let's say you have a home on a permanent foundation on land that you own. The bank sees an asset permanently tied to real estate. In many cases, you can get a regular mortgage with standard amortization periods and low down payments.
Wait, let me challenge that logic for a second. You're telling me a bank will gladly lend me $1 million for a condo in a high rise where I technically don't own the dirt beneath my feet, but they balk at financing a $100,000 modular home sitting on a lease pad in a quiet park. How does that make any sense?
I know, it sounds crazy, but it comes down to the mechanism of the law. With a high-rise condo, you are buying into a strata or a condominium corporation. You actually do have a fractional, legally binding ownership stake in the real estate.
Okay, so the land and the building structure itself.
Exactly. But with a home on a leased pad, you only rent the dirt. You own the box, but the landlord owns the earth. Because the structure isn't permanently tied to real estate you own, the legal system categorizes the home as personal property.
Like a boat or a car.
Exactly the same legal category. And the financial term for this is a chattel loan.
Chattel loan.
Yeah. And chattel loans have entirely different mechanics than traditional mortgages. They usually require much higher down payments, they carry higher interest rates, and they have much shorter repayment terms.
Because it's riskier.
Right. Think about it. If a bank has to repossess a house on leased land, they have to figure out how to sell it or physically move it off someone else's property. That is a massive headache for a big financial institution.
And the source notes that big national banks actively avoid chattel loans for exactly this reason, right?
Yeah.
Like, their algorithms just aren't built for that kind of bespoke risk.
National banks operate on volume and standardization. A chattel loan requires a deep understanding of the specific local market and the specific park the home is sitting in.
It's too hands-on for them.
Way too hands-on. It requires a human being to assess the situation, not just a computer model. This is where local credit unions really step in.
Yeah, the guide highlights Stellar Vista in the Kootenays as an example of this.
Right. Credit unions operate differently by design. They understand the communities they lend in. to a banking algorithm in Toronto, a chattel loan on a park model in a small BC town looks like a high-risk anomaly.
Flashing red lights.
Totally. But to a local credit union, it looks like a standard, everyday housing choice for their community members. They understand the value of the park, they assess the CSA code, and they finance the home fairly because they aren't relying purely on a rigid national risk model.
So keeping your financial conversations local seems essential when you're doing something outside the traditional suburban box.
Highly recommended, yes.
Okay, so we've picked the right standard. We found a local lender who understands chattel loans. We've secured the financing. We are ready to move in. Except, financing and building codes don't actually dictate where you are allowed to put the house.
Not at all.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Just because the province says your house is legally built and structurally safe does not mean your local municipality says it's legal for you to live in it full time.
Yeah, this invisible wall catches so many buyers off guard. You have to separate the spheres of power.
Okay, how so?
Provinces dictate building standards. Their primary concern is physics and safety. Will the roof collapse under a heavy snow load? Will the electrical panel catch fire?
The structural stuff.
Right. But municipalities and regional districts dictate zoning. They decide where things actually go.
But why do municipalities care so much if my tiny home is safe and I own the lot? I mean, what is the actual mechanism of their pushback?
It's a combination of infrastructure load and tax revenue.
Okay.
Imagine a lot zoned for one single-family house. The local government has engineered the sewer lines, the water pressure, and the road capacity for one family. If you suddenly drop four tiny homes on that lot, you quadruple the strain on that infrastructure.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about the sewer lines.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. Furthermore, tiny homes often don't generate the same property tax revenue as a massive house, meaning the municipality isn't collecting the funds needed to upgrade the sewer line you just overloaded.
Which creates a massive deficit for the town.
Exactly. Add in neighbors who might complain about the aesthetic changing the character of the street, and you get strict zoning bylaws.
The source does point out some recent provincial changes in BC, designed to force municipalities to be more flexible, though, specifically regarding accessory dwelling units, or ADUs.
Right, the ADU push.
Yeah, the province is trying to make it easier to add a guest house, a cabin, or a studio to a property that already has a primary residence.
The province is pushing for density to solve the housing crisis, sure, but the implementation still happens at the municipal level. The province might mandate that municipalities allow ADUs, but the local government controls the fine print.
So they can still make it difficult.
Oh, very. They can dictate height restrictions, setback requirements from the property line, and mandatory parking spaces. It is never a blanket free-for-all.
And if you are looking at placing a small home on a rural lot for recreational use, the rules seem to fracture even further.
Wildly further. The jurisdiction dictates everything. Are you inside a municipality? Are you in a regional district with different planning goals?
Right.
Is the land part of the agricultural land reserve, which strictly controls non-farming structures? Are you bordering crown land?
It's a minefield.
Every single designation comes with a dense framework of rules. Assuming, hey, it's my land, I can put whatever I want on it, that is the fastest way to end up in a massive legal battle.
But the guide offers an incredibly simple, actionable solution to avoid this entirely.
It really does.
A 5-minute phone call. Before you make an offer on an empty lot, before you put down a deposit on a custom modular home, you call the local planning department.
Yes, please call them.
You give them the specific address and you ask very specific questions based on the mechanics we've discussed. Like, can a CSA Z240 structure be a primary residence on this lot? What are the exact requirements for tying into the city sewer versus installing a septic system?
People skip this step because they fall in love with the aesthetic first. They buy the land, order the house, and then ask for permission.
Which is backwards.
Totally backwards. And a veteran local lender can also be a massive asset here. They have seen every zoning mistake possible in their specific region. Taking 5 minutes to have that conversation with a planner can save you from an agonizing after-the-fact variance process where the city literally forces you to move the structure.
Oof, yeah. Which brings us to the final piece of the puzzle. We've cleared the legal hurdles, mapped out the financing, checked the zoning. Now we have to strip away the romance and look at the day-to-day dollars and cents reality.
Real-world application.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because comparing the sticker price of a factory-built tiny home to a traditional house is very much like buying a ticket on a budget airline.
That is the perfect analogy. You see the base fare, maybe $80,000 for a beautiful modular unit, and it looks incredibly accessible.
It looks like a steal. But then you get to the airport, you have to pay for your carry-on bag, you want a window seat, extra, you want water, extra. By the time you board the plane, the price has doubled. The same mechanism applies to small homes. That $80,000 sticker price does not include the baggage fees of real estate. You have to factor in purchasing the land or paying monthly pad rent. You have to clear trees and level the dirt.
Dirt work is so expensive.
Yes. You have to dig trenches to bring utility connections from the street to the structure. You have to pay delivery fees, pour concrete pad, pull municipal permits, and install a driveway.
It adds up fast. When you aggregate those hidden costs, the final number looks very different. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you also have to consider how the financial system views that final number over a 20-year timeline.
Right.
The source brings up a crucial distinction between depreciation and appreciation. Traditional real estate, like a permanent house on owned land, historically appreciates because the dirt becomes more valuable. The house rides the wave of the land value.
Makes sense.
But smaller homes, particularly those on leased land or built on chassis, often behave more like vehicles. They depreciate as they age.
So you are actively trading the potential for long-term equity growth for the immediate reality of lower monthly overhead.
It is a deliberate trade-off. Lenders are acutely aware of this depreciation curve. An older mobile home represents a higher risk because its underlying value is dropping.
Right. They don't want to be left holding the bag.
Exactly. That translates to shorter amortization periods, meaning you have to pay the loan back faster, and stricter inspection requirements. But the guide is clear. Plenty of people make this trade-off willingly.
Because it fits their life.
Yeah. They aren't looking for a financial investment vehicle. They are looking for stability and freedom from a massive mortgage.
Which leads to the physical day-to-day reality check. Picture your daily routine on a dark, freezing Canadian winter evening in a 400-square-foot space.
Oh, it's tight.
Very tight. Think about the mechanics of cooking a complex dinner with minimal counter space. Think about where your giant, soaking wet winter coat and your muddy snow boots actually go when you walk through the front door.
There's no mudroom.
No. And if you invite three friends over, where do they physically sit? Shrinking your footprint changes the geometry of your entire life. It forces an intense intentionality upon every single object you own.
Every square inch has to serve a functional purpose. I mean, for some, that enforced simplicity is deeply freeing.
Totally.
But for others, the novelty wears off rapidly, and they realize they just deeply miss having an extra closet to throw their junk in. You really have to know the difference between loving the idea of a minimalist lifestyle and actually thriving in one.
So what does this all mean? When we zoom out and look at the CSA codes, the mechanical risk of steel chassis, the municipal battles over sewer loads, and the reality of chattel loans, it becomes obvious that the small home movement isn't just an architectural trend.
No, it's way bigger than that.
It is a massive structural response to a broken traditional housing market.
Mm.
People are actively realizing they want the financial freedom to live their lives, rather than just working constantly to fund a sprawling basement they rarely use.
That's the ultimate takeaway here. A home is a home, regardless of whether it spans 3,000 square feet with a basement or 400 square feet on a steel chassis.
Right.
The key to successfully navigating this shift isn't just passion, it's preparation. You have to understand the specific building standards, secure the right land, and map that onto the specific financial tools available.
Doing your homework.
Exactly. Doing that mechanical groundwork allows you to make a decision with absolute confidence.
It's about being rigorously informed so you can actually enjoy the lifestyle you're trying to build. And that brings us to a final thought I want to leave you with today. We started by talking about how that traditional image of the big house on the private fenced-in lot is changing.
Right.
If we continue on this path, if a large portion of society embraces highly efficient, significantly smaller personal living spaces to gain financial freedom, how might that fundamental shift alter the mechanics of our communities?
That's a great question.
If our private living rooms shrink, will our public spaces, like our parks, local cafes, and community centers, effectively become our new shared living rooms? Think about how the very fabric of your town might change, how infrastructure might need to adapt if everyone lived just a little bit smaller and had to step outside their fence to really stretch out.
It's a whole new way of living together.
It really is. Something to think about the next time you walk through your neighborhood. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, and we'll catch you on the next one.